The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And this one is interesting because I'm here with a human being. And to let everyone know, Jason, my guest, is at one end of the table. I am at the other end of the table. So this is still proper social distancing because, let's face it, everyone's doing a little judging and shaming when we see people walking and you should be single file and this or that. So just getting that out of the way. But I'm joined by Jason Axsmith from, is it Cosecha Imports?
It's Cosecha.
Cosecha. Damn it. I knew I was going to screw it up. My streak continues. Jason Axsmith, who works with, if, I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit first about your company.
Sure. So I'm born and bred in Toronto. Over 20 years ago, I moved to Spain and went down the rabbit hole of wine and winemaking and getting to know winemakers and restaurateurs, etc. And 5 years ago, we set up a company called Cosecha, which means harvest in Spanish, to bring wines that had never been brought to Ontario before.
We'll get into it because here's what I want to do with this. And I should also tell people that we're friends. We have, you know, my cousins and you are friends. And because of your relationship with my cousins, we met years and years and years ago and have hung out a bunch. So just putting that all out there. But what I want to do with this podcast is almost treat it a bit like Spanish 101. And the reason is none of your wines are Rioja, are they?
We do.
You do have Rioja, but none of the four here.
That's correct.
Yeah, I should tell people there's one white and we got three reds. And I think a lot of people, they know about Rioja. They might know, you know, a little bit about Ribera del Douro. But then after that, I feel like the knowledge gap takes a bit of a drop. I know it did with me for years. Like I always said Spain was a bit of a blind spot. So I kind of wanted just to have you on to try some wines and to have you talk about them, the producers, because you got tons of great stories from all these relationships you've made over the years.
Yeah, so I live half the year in Barcelona, and much of my work there is involved in selection of our producers and the relationship with those producers. We're actually making some of our own cuvées and take part in the harvest and bottling and blending of many of them. So there's a little piece of me in all of the wines, essentially. But, you know, Spain, for so many years, in a lot of ways, Spain lost its way. I mean, when we started to look at the market here in Ontario, Spain only had 4% versus Italy and France with 20 and 25% of the market. And again, as you mentioned, Rioja, Ribera del Duero, and in some cases, Priorat was really top of mind. I mean, the history of wine in Spain, you know, you've got to go back to the 80s and 90s when Spain came out of being ruled by a dictator and came online with the EU. And winemaking never really had this kind of history or panache the way it did in Italy or in France. It was typically produced to make bulk wine or distilled spirits. All of the grapes, irregardless of quality, were vinified together. And at best, you were getting really
generic
and really industrial production. So it favored the cooperatives. And, you know, winemakers started to use American oak because they thought they could sell more wine in the U.S. They started to plant non-indigenous varietals like, and you know, we've got some examples here today, but Cab Sauv, Chardonnay, etc. And they sort of moved away from those indigenous varietals that had been there really for centuries, pre-phylloxera. So, you know, there's like a new wave movement of younger winemakers that are really coming back to making wines that are more typical of the wines their grandparents drank, lighter, more perfumed, less alcohol, less extraction. And that's really the movement that we've really taken advantage of. I mean, people ask me what's different about us, and it's like I always say, we're representing the Led Zeppelin, Beatles, and Rolling Stones of Spanish wine today, and it's really exciting.
Well, yeah, just hearing that, it feels like for Spain, the motivation to make wine was all just about economics. So it wasn't about what's the best expression of the terroir. It's how are we going to be able to sell the wine to an international market? Huh, Cabernet Chardonnay. Everyone knows those grapes, so let's plant them. And then also it felt like, and this is more ironic now, it's a bit more when I think about Rioja, so much overly oaked, like just oaked to death. Like that That was my image of Spanish wine from the 90s.
Well, and it's interesting when you talk about Rioja and industrial production. I mean, literally in the span of a decade, they went from, you know, producing 80 million bottles to 400 million bottles. I could go on about Rioja and Tempranillo. It's a grape that's beautifully adapts to the terroir in Spain, but doesn't necessarily express the history and tradition. You look at grapes like Graciano or Grenache that were typically planted in Rioja, and they've been uprooted and grafted with Tempranillo. So it's a fascinating look back into the history of agronomy, really.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about just, was there that moment where you started to fall in love with wine? But let's interweave what you've brought here today. And are all these wines available to order from your company?
They are. You know, I think of Spain for an importer. I think the hardest task is it's like assembling a puzzle or pieces of a symphony together. You can't double your percussion or your string section. It's like a puzzle. You can't do two of the same pieces. So for me, I always look to try to represent the best in a region. There's a small nexus of younger winemakers, and they all drink each other's wine. They travel together. They drink wine. In order to make the best wine in the world, you have to drink the best wine from outside of your area. It's amazing to me how many winemakers only drink their own wine or the wine of the people around them. But my story goes back to when I first, you know, moved to Spain, and I married into a family that always had wine at their core. And part of my getting into my adopted country was starting to travel out and starting to go to restaurants. And through relationships with restaurateurs, I started to meet winemakers, and I started to bring back these wines. And with a nexus of collectors here in Toronto, slowly but surely we started to determine that, hey, these are wines that would be gorgeous in the marketplace. These are not like wines that anyone has any reference point for in terms of Spain. And so I don't think there was like one inflection point where it was an aha moment, right? But you know, winemakers time and time again would say, I don't understand your province. I keep getting emails from people that say they want to be my representative. This LCBO, this big bad LCBO. I have no idea what's gonna happen, and it just was a gradual process.
By the way, every time I've traveled to Italy or France, whenever I'm talking to the winemaker or the winery owner, eventually, oh, where are you from? I'm from Toronto, Ontario, and they usually lower their head and they shake their head, and they just, you can tell when you say the word Toronto, Ontario, they immediately think LCBO, always. And it's never filled, their heart is never filled with joy when they think of the LCBO, which we could do a whole podcast on that. But first, what's the white wine that we got?
So when I think of Spain, and many in your audience have traveled to Spain, I always think of Spain in three ways. I think Atlantic. Mm-hmm. Continental,
yep,
and Mediterranean in terms of geography, in terms of situating oneself. So we're going to start with the Atlantic. So the province of Galicia, it resembles, it's what they call it, Celtic Spain. You've got redheads running around. I mean, obviously the Irish came down and did their duty. But I mean, rolling green hills. This is a white wine from Galicia. It's an Albariño grape. It's Old Vine Albariño. There are really four producers in that area that are producing the best whites in that area, and this is one of them. So this is Churcho Alba of Albemarle. His dad was a bricklayer, lost his job. They went back to the 2.5 hectares that the family had in Cambados, just outside of Vigo. After his formal training, which took him to France, he came back, had a number of ideas to bring back a minimal intervention style. I mean, most of the grapes that were ultimately destined for the distillery, but he started to take some of these ideas that he gleaned from abroad, and is making just gorgeous, rich, plush wine. So this is first vinified in steel, and then goes back to neutral French oak, which is very typical of a lot of our wines. Oak should be used to give some texture, not to be a dominant part of the wine. And I think it's really one of the best examples of a wine that also has tremendous age potential.
Okay, see, the oak, now it makes sense. one of the stereotypes that I have with a lot of white wines from that area, whether it be Albarino or Alvarino, because it's great that screw people up. Just change the V, you know, or the B, and now no one knows what they're drinking. But I get usually much more neutral nose. You search for a bit, you find the lemon lime, you know, you find that kind of stuff and some of this minerality. But this, like, there's like a mint. There's a very light mint. There is a soft soap. There's a little sweetness to it. There is more going on in this nose than I usually get from a lot of the Alvarinos that that you would find at the Evil LCBO.
Well, there's quince paste here. I just spent harvest with Churcho and his family, and it's a fascinating story. They made wine in a clandestine cellar, and they also had a clandestine restaurant. They're literally facing the sea. This is sand. This is sea. There's a salinity to this wine.
Yep.
You know, this quince paste, lemon that you mentioned. So exciting to finally have this cuvée here. This is his top tier. This is an homage to his brother who passed away in a car accident. This is his brother's birth certificate on them. When we talk
really?
About stories,
Jesus.
Right on the label.
Wow.
So this is a wine that really, he was supposed to be here this month for up close and personal, but we'll just have to wait until after harvest or when we get this whole thing solved. But I think by far one of the best winemakers. He was voted the best winemaker in Galicia by his peers, not by
press
or anyone else. And mm-hmm. is just such a wonderful, wonderful human being. And
imagine the pressure to make a good wine for this vintage if he's putting his brother's birth certificate on it, who passed, as you said, passed away in a car. I mean, that's a sad story, but like, there's pressure. It's like, you're honoring your brother. You want to make sure it's a good wine. And this is, I love the nose on this fella.
Yeah, there's a such a plushness and richness to this at the same time. I mean, all of our wines are food wines, and I mean, I think there's an accessibility. If you know, when some people ask me, well, how do you select your producer? And I know a lot of people say, well, if I drink it, I want to drink the whole bottle.
Yep.
But for me, also, I have to love the person behind it, and I think that's what also differentiates us.
Well, I was going to say, you know, you said, you know, I spent the harvest with them. Of the wines that you represent, how much time do you spend with the winemakers?
Well, in every case, it's like when you buy a car, you've got to take the car for a test drive. So, you know, we've got a core criteria or philosophy, and you've got to go to the vineyard. You've got to be able to transmit the excellence in the vineyard, but also make sure that it's what they claim is the truth. I mean, I know a lot of importers and distributors, they go to Pro Wine and they meet a producer. But to me, I don't understand how you can really transmit. The best winemakers transmit you to a time and a place, a vintage. Was it dry? Was it cool? And for me, I've got to go and kick the tires and meet the people behind the wines. I've got to meet the team. I've got to walk through the vines and see, is the farming sustainable? We only work with farmers that farm sustainably. It's organic or it's biodynamic, sometimes certification, sometimes not. Indigenous varietals. Oak neutrality, spontaneous fermentation, non-industrial yeast, etc. Because mm-hmm. you're really trying to transmit the place and the fruit, and that's what I think you get from this wine.
How much was wine part of your life before you moved to Spain?
I grew up with wine, in our family, but it was, you know, my dad grew up with Calabreses, being a good North Toronto Jewish guy, but they at best had, you know, bulk wine and. Or Manischewitz on a Friday night. Ugh. So it wasn't part of my DNA the way that it has become since moving to Spain. I married into a family that had grapes in at their core, and so much of me connecting with that family was connecting over wine, and it just was slowly that walk into the abyss, as it were, and here we are today.
How is it? I want to bounce back and forth between these wines, your history, the company. But how is coronavirus? How has it affected you? I mean, it's funny, even coming in here, we're like, do we hug? Do we shake hands? What do we like? Everyone's doing the same dance, like just from on the business side. How is it affecting the company?
Yeah. So, you know, we. we're very fortunate to be in a very strong position. We have a very loyal following of private clients who have, you know, I mean, Spain is top of mind, and Barcelona, where I live half the year, you know, is one of the, has a, even potentially a stronger brand than Spain overall. I mean, everyone knows Barcelona Football Club, mm-hmm. Gaudi, Sagrada Familia, Picasso, etc. So we've had a great following, and they've really stepped up in this really 2 months that we've been under lockdown. We have friends and family in the hospitality sector, and we feel for them. We're in touch with them every day. I mean, I make part of my mission every day to drop a bottle of wine off to someone in the space who is right now with an unknown future, etc. But fortunately, we've had an online marketplace from day one, and we're in a very strong position. We've decided not to add any new producers to our portfolio. We had a whole plan of expansion for Cosecha International this year, which we've obviously put on hold to really strengthen and really create a fortress around the producers that we've been working with for the past 5 years. But we're in a very, very fortunate position. It's very difficult for our Spanish producers, and I'll be going home shortly back to Spain. The domestic market has imploded for them, so there's a surplus of wine, and it's going to be a real issue as we go into the summer, because a lot of wine won't get bottled, and there'll be a question of what to do with it. But for us here in Ontario, because of the loosening of regulations, and your local restaurant is now able to sell wine by the bottle, delivery or pickup, this has been a great opportunity for people that love wine in the province.
And what's the website? Where can people, want to give you a couple
Cosecha plugs. CosechaImports.com. CosechaImports.com.
CosechaImports.com.
Cosecha means harvest, by the way, which is...
which is a great name. It's better than whatever the Spanish, if there's, what's Spanish for bulk?
Granel.
Yeah, see, that would be the last name you want for a wine consignment company, or any sort of wine import export company where it's named after bulk. Harvest, much better name. Oh, we were talking before about this. What has been the biggest, like, you've been in Spain and you've been in Toronto. What's been the biggest difference in terms of what you've seen in terms of how they've been handling coronavirus?
When, in early March, when things started to hit Europe, it first hit Italy and then slowly started to make its way over to Spain. There was really this kind of status quo, nonchalant. When lockdown happened on March 11th, many people said, oh, this is where, you know, work's closed. I'm, you know, been sent home. I can go to my country house, or I can go to the beach. And
right.
There was, I
so
think,
it was Florida. It was Florida.
It was Florida. And yeah. And I think, you know, in looking at this, and I put my economist hat on, because before I got into the wine business, you know, I went through and I did my MBA and worked on Bay Street and did 10 years in the consulting world. You know, there's really three things that it takes to get over this. It's healthcare, government, and social capital. And Spain, Italy, and some parts of the Mediterranean, I think, have fallen down and have faced the consequences. We've handled this crisis tremendously here in Ontario, and we'll get through this. And it's not an existential question. I mean, if not to get into the more philosophical part, but we have this chance right now to pull the layer back and hit the pause button. And I hope that we come through this with greater solidarity to fight existential questions like food insecurity and climate change. And we'll be better off as a planet, I hope, for this. And we don't just revert back to this faith in charlatans, and let's go back to faith in experts.
Yeah.
Winemakers are, you know, work continues in the vineyard.
Oh yeah. Every winemaker I've interviewed the last couple of weeks, like, oh yeah, I just came from the vineyard. I just came from the fields, you know, and you're right. Because nature's still going on. There's still sun and rain and think about Southern Ontario. They're not worried about coronavirus, the winemakers. They were worried last weekend about frost killing their crops like it did in Prince Edward County in 2015.
Yeah, it's, I mean, a lot of our winemakers have said this is like a really bad vintage.
Really?
For them. I mean, it's actually shaping up in a lot of, like, we continue to make cuvées. So we've got, you know, our prospects on expanding that. We currently have three cuvées, two of which will be coming into market this summer. The third one that we're making in Mallorca will be later in 2020, early 2021. But we've got an idea, like with this white winemaker, to make a cuvée. So of course, all the questions are, how are you? How are things? How can we help? And they're looking to us for leadership, because Ontario, we continue to buy wine. Mm-hmm. And that says a lot, because in the US, the Trump tax, Then this, it's we're in a very fortunate position in Ontario. So back to the business part, we will continue to buy wine, and it only benefit the consumer ultimately.
Question about you: how much happier are you representing wine and wineries versus your, as you said, 10 years on Bay Street?
Going back to me, when I was 28, I went back. I did my, you know, I went back to graduate school. I did an MBA and I came out. I had the herd mentality and I did what everyone else did. You're looking for the strong return on your investment. But I never asked myself the really important questions of what did I love to do? Where could I make a difference? Mm-hmm. And what could I be best in the world at? I went down this path of doing something that really I wasn't passionate about. I didn't love to do. You know, you say like, you know, going back to the salt mines every day. I mean, that's what it felt like working on Bay Street. When I started this company with my original business partner in 2014, we were looking at buying an existing agency to leapfrog the whole consignment fiasco. And, you know, looking back, I mean, it's not a path to riches and millions,
no.
But in terms of self-fulfillment, I mean, what gives me such pride is meeting these old farmers who have toiled over these ancient vineyards. I mean, that's what's so interesting about Spain is you have these vineyards, like the first red wine we're going to have, it's like 100-year-old Grenache vines. And when I meet them and the tears well up in their eyes, when they think of Canada and they think of Banff and they think of Lake Louise, stuff that they've only seen on TV. And when they think of their grapes going into a product that lands on these shores and giving pleasure to people. I mean, we ultimately improve the quality of people's lives. And I don't think I did that with my 10 years on Bay Street in a corporate setting.
Winemakers are awesome. I mean, in general, I know there's bad ones out there, just like there's bad everything, but there's a work ethic, there's a pride, there's usually some science, there's this respect for nature, you got to get it done. You know, just get shit done, people. And I find that, you know, winemakers are just really, for the most part, I've met just fantastic salt of the earth sort of people. So let's get to the first red we're having. Yeah. So what's this first red?
Okay. So just to continue again, Atlantic, Continental, Mediterranean. We're continuing with the Atlantic, just about 100 kilometers inland from the coast where the first white was the Albarino. Mm-hmm. This is a field blend. So this is a producer, Fideos do Couto. I know these are things that are not easy to pronounce or recognize, etc.
You're talking to the king of mispronunciation.
So this is a Ribera Sacra, which is an up and coming for a lot of people. Goes back to grape growing, goes back to ancient times, typically high acid, which is why it was sort of frowned upon, again, going back to the history. Albarino grapes headed for the distillery. No one wanted the high acidity that these made, and typically these would just be, you know, made into bulk or you know, put into 16-liter carafes that would be drunk by families. But these are old vines. So these are 60 to 100 years old, but this has white varietals, red varietals. A lot of these will not be familiar top of mind varietals.
Right.
Muraton, Bastardo, which is Trousseau, Doña Blanca, Godello, some Albarino. Mm-hmm. And all of these were co-vinified. The white grape varietals would be over mature, but they would give lift and a really nice pop in terms of acidity. And in come a bunch of young guys who met farming agriculture family who for three generations have traveled back to the country from the cities to continue to till these. I mean, I have photos, which your viewers can't see, but it's just unbelievable to see these craggy vines sticking out of these primarily slate and sand hillsides at 900 meters of altitude. But what you get in the glass is, I find, gorgeous acidity, perfumed, ethereal, but still with the Atlantic as the key driver.
So again, the region is Sacra?
Well, it's not Ribera Sacra. It's very close to there. It's
very
actually
close.
It's out of the DO. This is wine that's out of the DO because this is it is in the Val d'Oro's region, but because this is, again, it's a whole other topic about the controversy about DOs and appellations there, as many people would refer to them. But this is, again, an Atlantic wine from Celtic Galicia, Green Galicia, field blend, 900 meters of altitude, just inland from
Sacra.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And I mean, one thing I like is old vine, Czech, altitude, good thing, good soil. That's a combination you want to see. I guess the hardest thing about this wine, and I'll smell and taste in a second, is it can be sometimes hard to sell unknown or Yeah, unknown varietals can be difficult, and field blends can be as well, because for some people, their mind can process Pinot, Cabernet, even, okay, Tempranillo or Grenache, I can get that. But this one must be, until they try it or hear the story, this must be, could be a harder sell.
Well, it's interesting then, and I'd actually counter that. I think a market like Ontario, which is in so many ways just really awakening to, in a lot of ways, the world of wine. Here at the, and one great thing about the LCBO is you can find wines from all over the world. You can find wines from Armenia. You can find wines really from every corner of the ancient and new world. And people here, when you say grape varietals they don't know, you tell them, you give them a comparable, and you say, you know, perhaps this is drinking like a lighter style, a Pinot, a lighter style of Grenache, etc.
I was going to think some sort of like, my first thought was I was heading towards Beaujolais.
Yeah, there's a poppy element there, Gamay. Mm-hmm. And you give them a comparable, but you tell a little bit of the story, and people are much more open. Actually, I would say selling wine to a Spaniard is much more difficult. I live in Barcelona, mm-hmm. and selling wine, red wine from near Barcelona to a Catalan is a very difficult sell.
Really?
Because they've got it in their mind that it's Rioja, it's Ribera del Duero. It's all the stereotypes. It's as
so
we
even
say
in Spain, even in Spain they do it.
So I think actually the market here is more open, thanks to the culture of wine now that's popping up all over the city with wine bars that are bringing in quote unquote natural wine or minimal intervention wine, whatever you want to call it.
Archive, Midfield,
Paris.
Yep.
Paradise Grapevine,
yep.
You know, even very close to us here in the Distillery District, Madrina, one of the best restaurants there, very much alive to, we can almost see it,
yeah,
very much alive to this new generation of Spanish winemaker. And this is, I mean, even for people like Jura, you could say, I mean, there's a really interesting comparable here.
Ethereal is the perfect way to describe it. Very fresh, nice acid. This is a wine where you're going to have a glass and you're going to want to have a second glass, which is the classic line about if a wine is good or not. There's nothing heavy about it. There's certainly, it's a nice dance between freshness, but with enough depth.
Yeah. And, you know, 12.5% alcohol.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is, you know,
I would have gone under, I would have, it's funny. I think I would have gone 12 to 11.5 when, I think that's sort of where I was going. Okay, so 12.5 actually is a little bit higher than I expected.
Well, it's, you know, also when we talk about wines and wines going back, people talk about the Spanish Revolution. You go and you see Noble Rod in the UK and you see International Press and thanks to them and thanks to Eric Asimov and Chances Robinson, you know, talking about all of these winemakers, you can go and see front cover of Noble Rot or feature of Janice Robinson for these winemakers. She's written about all of them. You know, what's interesting is that this is a style of wine that goes back to their grandparents. Back when there was a lack of fresh water in the vineyard, you know, if you were working the vines, as anyone who's done harvest knows, you're there from sun up to sun down,
yeah.
And you don't typically have, now you do, but before you wouldn't have had access to fresh water. So you're drinking a liter or a liter and a half a day. The story is about these guys who have hands like, you know, meat hands, I guess, like
yep.
Giant, you know, working the land all their lives, they would drink, you know, a liter and a half, 2 liters a day. And you can't be doing that with high alcohol wines,
no.
Heavily extracted wines. You need wines that are light like this. Also that are cutting the fat content of fatty foods, cured meats, cheeses. This is a perfect accompaniment for that.
I'm having some cured meat with it right now. Absolutely. Would you say that part of it is just, it's easier to sell, as you say, in Toronto because open-mindedness. How much of this played on younger wine drinkers or millennials?
There's a little bit of both. You know, we have some of the most traditionalist collectors as part of our community. You know, I mean, these wines are celebrated from Hong Kong to London. This was the thesis for our business was, no one is championing these wines here. And I won't say names, but I remember interviewing with all of the top importers in the city. They told me that I would never be able to launch a business on the back of Spain alone. And the first question I had for them, and it was respectfully because I was a buyer from all of these these importers. When was the last time they traveled to Spain? And they all told me the same thing. It doesn't matter. What do you know? Et cetera, et cetera. You're not a formally trained sommelier, et cetera.
But wow, you got all that, didn't you?
and you know, and it was that key differential of being on the ground, meeting winemakers, knowing sommeliers and restaurateurs, and seeing what was celebrated on the ground there, and exploiting that market opportunity. And that's what Cosecha did in 2015.
I will not ask you to snitch on who the consignment companies are. I was going to make a joke or say the first letter because I think it would give it away, but we're going to move on. And in fact, we're going to stick on this theme of snitching. You worked on Bay Street for 10 years. Do you have any stories, and this might be a tricky one, of the biggest Bay Street wine mistakes? And I'll give you an example. When I was interviewing Allison Vidug from Shore Club, and it was called the Bay Street Combo, where it would be the bottle of not Opus One, but like cake bread with the seafood tower. It would be the Napa Cabernet with the seafood tower. I'm not always a believer in food pairing. I think sometimes if you love a food and you love the wine, pair them together. Great. Have a great night. I ain't here to tell you what you like or don't like, but I am here to tell you, you don't have cake bread with a goddamn seafood tower.
Well, I don't know if it would be, a faux pas in that way. I mean, white Burgundy with an ice cube in the glass, perhaps. I've seen that. And I've also seen that in Barcelona. One of the iconic venues for wine in Barcelona is a place called Mont Vinic that a gentleman named Sergi Ferrer Salat established probably 15 years ago. And it was a place where you could go in and you could get wines from the world. You could get Felton Road by the glass. I mean, it was it was unbelievable at a certain point. And that's where I really, again, started to go down this rabbit hole. I started to meet sommeliers who, when we first started, I said, if we were to set up an importing company, give us a list of the top wines that you would, the dream list. And that's, I went around with a dream list and started to contact two of the producers of the wines that we're tasting here today. So no faux pas per se. I mean, I think as you go through the world of wine, you like this visceral hammer over their head, purple explosion, big, heavy fruit. If the bottle is heavy, it's got to be a great wine. And then you move into, the best wine, the enophiles and collectors in the world, where do they cherish? They cherish Burgundy. They cherish Pinot, for example. I think the biggest faux pas is when people ask me, to be honest, they ask me, what's this grape varietal like? And I say, it's like... what it is. If I asked you, what is a Pinot like?
Where is it from?
You would say where it's from, but yeah. Pinot is a Pinot.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I think it's...
I have in my mind, when I think Pinot, there are certain things I have in terms of the acid should be around here, the tannin should be around here, the alcohol should be here, unless it's from Sonoma. Now, the alcohol is going to be way higher than it should be. But yeah, no, I do have an archetype in my head for a lot of the grapes.
Well, you ask about faux pas. The one story comes to mind. I was with a winemaker the last wine that we'll taste today from his estate, and a very prominent winemaker from here in Jordan, Ontario. And we were tasting with another producer in Spain, and out comes the top parcel Priorat wine, 500 bottles only, single barrel, huge premium, and we all thought it was a supermarket wine. So, that's sometimes where wine just puts you in your place.
But there is nothing more humbling than the blind taste. And when you see master wine, like the masters of wine, like literally the MWs of the world, when you see them screw it up, you're like, what chance do I have? How did that person call a Bordeaux a Chianti? And it can mess with you. And most of these wines would not be testable. The white certainly would. The second one, the field blend, it wouldn't. But I'm still going Beaujolais. That's my first thought. Mm. Feels more red fruit, more soft, fragrant red. This isn't overly ripe. This is more of a softer raspberry thing that I got going on here.
Do you like it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I am a fan of fresh. You know, just, I mean, but then that's a Captain Obvious point. It's like saying I don't like waiting in line. No one likes waiting in line, and everyone should like fresh.
And I love tension in wine. I mean, it has to have tension. What I can't, you know, but I really appreciate that sort of nerve that you feel. And in some ways, this wine is sort of blending that nerve and tension and acidity that you'd find with a with a white wine, and again coming back to the history, and I wanted to choose some wines that would throw you for a little bit of a curve.
Love it. By the way, you were talking about a ice cube in white Burgundy over Christmas. I brought a magnum of a Premier Cru Pour le Nez Montrachet. I'm pouring it for people, and one person asked, could I have an ice cube in it? I stopped and we had an uncomfortable 3-second pause and my face contorted and did 500 different negative reactions, but not huge, like little mini ones, just, and then they kind of sensed it and they're like, oh, and I'm like, no. I'm like, hey, do me a favor, just try some. If you want an ice cube afterwards, I'll give you an ice cube. And guess what? They never asked for the ice cube.
Well, it's fascinating. You know, we get asked quite often at trade tastings, portfolio tastings, private tastings. We get a lot of, you know, people look at the color of a wine. So these wine, two of the wines are lighter in color, lighter in style.
Yeah.
The amount of people that look at the wine and make their decision just on the color before they smell, before they taste, before they ask.
Yeah.
They've already made their decision. Oh, it's going to be lighter in I don't like light wines.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, a lot of these reds, I mean, it's like a Maserati. You see those sleek design lines, but you feel that rumble from when that motor passes you by. I mean,
oh, yeah.
It shakes you to your core. And I think people ask me all the time, said, well, I really like Napa, Cab. And what I've realized before, it used to not upset me, but it would kind of get me standoffish.
Now
I know exactly what they want. And I know exactly what in our portfolio I can give them to give them that sense of pleasure.
So what would that be? Someone says, and you know what? Someone says to you, Jason, I'm new in a wine. I've been drinking the Napa Cabs. I've been drinking the Australian Shirazes, and I really like them. But I want to try something else. What would you throw out there?
Well, we'll have to get to the final wine because I think it's also a curveball because of its weight and power. But you know, certainly when you think of for me, freshness, accessibility is really important. So you have to embrace the heat. I mean, in Spain, you can't get away from it. There's been a tendency to pick too early and you get these green wines and like low alcohol just for the sake of having low alcohol. And you say it's part of the new wave.
The problem with that, sorry to interrupt, and I hate this, and is when you're winemaking, you're saying on the outside, it's about this new wave and we want lower alcohol. But really, that in a way is its own marketing. That's marketing versus is the wine great? You can tell me your wine is totally unfiltered and we don't touch it. We don't do a thing. But sometimes you need a little filter. Sometimes you need a little sulfur. And I hate it, the people that like they sacrifice quality and they sacrifice their good terroir because they want to be able to tell you, hey, we do our wines the proper way. But oftentimes it's not.
You know, and this is a conversation point about natural wine. I mean, people talk about natural wine and they say, well, if you've added sulfites, it's like poison or what have you. We work with producers that respect their terroir. They respect the grapes. But they want to create gorgeous wine that's stable, that can travel across an ocean. And there's no problem with adding sulfites. There's vintages where you need to spray in the vineyard. I mean, 80% of winemaking is what happens in the vineyard. If you're not dominating the farming element, you can forget it. I mean, yeah. It's like a great chef. Bring the best possible ingredients, bring the best possible grapes, and get out of the way and don't screw it up. But the whole idea of natural wine, there's nothing natural about wine. Danny Landy from Commando G said this on his first visit here 3 years ago, and it's always stuck in my head, is, you know, grapes and agriculture, it's touched by the hand of man. So really, there's nothing natural about it. It's about creating something beautiful that will stand the test of time and can age.
Yeah.
And if that requires, in a certain vintage, a little more sulfites, that's the prerogative of the winemaker. Getting back to your point, something who wants a medium, full-bodied wine, that's the heat, Jumilla, Monastrell grape varietal, which is Mourvèdre in France.
Mm-hmm.
Gorgeous wines, And we've got a few producers in that region that are making gorgeous wines. But all through the Mediterranean, you can find that.
And by the way, Commando G, that is a wine producer. So,
yeah, Commando G.
You mentioned earlier, just for the listeners, if they don't, if they think it's one of the G.I. Joe characters that didn't make it.
Well, it's an interesting story. So just about an hour and a half southwest of Madrid, the first time that I went there, I mean, it's like equidistant Toronto to Newmarket. That's how close it is. Madrid to Gredos, this sort of mountainous area that looks like the minerality and granite soil is the core conductor for the wines that have been celebrated. Just last year, their single parcel Rumbel Norte received 100 points from Luis Gutierrez and have really become the darlings, and rightfully so. Fighting for a different style from a completely abandoned area of viticulture. And now everyone's sort of rushed in, but it's high altitude, variable vintage to vintage, but much more of a Burgundian concept. Maybe we can go to this.
Let's go to wine number three.
So speaking of Commando G, again, this is granitic soil. This is 100% Grenache, up to 100-year-old vines. It looks like the gods played bocce ball, throwing these giant granitic boulders, which are aimlessly strewn throughout the vines.
That's so much of Spain. There's so much of Spain that's like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And 30, 40-day maceration. I mean, it's like crossing Mordor. Mm-hmm. Danny's had viticulture in his family. He met Fernando Garcia at agronomy school. And they travel. They're one of the few non-French producers at La Dive en Bouteille every year. I passed out in their van this past year, but that's another story. I wasn't feeling that good. But great friends, and they become a pillar of our portfolio because it's Burgundian concept. Again, blind tasting. They don't think of Spain when they feel this wine, but this wine has. It has fennel. Fennel is tremendous off this. Orange peel. This is a wine that really helped put us on the map. This is Rosa's Premier Cru, hence their play on the appellation not respecting the quality of certain parcels over others. But this is one of the best wines in our portfolio.
I'm glad you said fennel because I'm going through the there's a lot on the nose. There's depth. You almost do like a Rolodex in your brain of flavor profiles because you're trying to figure out all the different things, yeah, that are going on. As you said, the fennel is there. More of a, I don't want to say cooked fruit because it's not that, but it's a little like there's...
Like a stewed
thank
fruit.
Thank you. Stewed fruit.
Stewed fruit.
Yep.
I get that fennel really is dominant on the nose, orange peel. This is a wine that's really emblematic of this producer. I mean, I've got a number of stories about Commando G. And again, Commando G is a cartoon series from the 80s where these superheroes had to defend the world from alien attack. And G stands for Grenache because they only work with Grenache except for one white varietal. Mm-hmm. So they're really playful. They play in rock and roll bands. It's a different community of winemakers now, but these are wines that are prized by négociants all over the world, and have really found a great home here in Ontario and in Canada. And we're really privileged to work with them, and they're great friends, like all of the people that we work with.
And it like for people that want bigger wines, this is not a big wine per se, but the tannins are there. Like the tannins will absolutely, you'll feel them at the end.
And they leave the fruit on the vine to mature. This was sort of the difference what they came to the region with in terms of their approach of winemaking, partly from their experiences in Jura with Ganevat and others, is, you know, allowing that extra maturation on the vine, that extended maceration period, to really create something that's perfumed and balanced. But it's 14.5% alcohol.
Yeah. You don't get on the back of the throat too much heat, but you can tell this is a big boy wine. Like this is one that you could call this a don't judge a book by its cover.
Absolutely.
When you look at it, and there's both red and dark fruit. There's a little smoky notes going on. Yeah, this Grenache. But you're right. When I first smell it, and some of that spice profile. Yeah, I could go Burgundy.
Well, it's interesting as well to then go back to the first red because, mm-hmm. well, also they play in a rock and roll band together. Kuro from the first wine is the bass player in Danny Landy's rock and roll troupe. And music and art and wine, it's all intertwined. So again, you asked me about my life now in terms of inspiration and admiration. And it's, you know, every time I come back from my trips to... out to see these guys, I come back more excited to transmit the essence of what they're trying to achieve. And they have to fight. They have to fight for it. I used to say that distributing beverage alcohol in the province of Ontario was the third worst work activity. Second was restaurants. And the first was growing grapes, growing estate grapes and making wine. I think it might be flipped now. But it's pretty exciting. I mean, these producers and some of our Ontario producers really feel in akin. It's exciting to see the way producers in one part of the world really identify themselves with others. I mean, you see Grenache producers in Australia now, and these guys, there's a similar approach in terms of Grenache from these really hot, inhospitable areas and what they're able to achieve in terms of freshness.
Do you get the feeling, is there more of a congenial spirit among all these new waves of winemakers? Because I know certainly parts of France, everyone's suspicious. And French winemakers are often suspicious of Italian winemakers and larger wineries often, you know, because it is a business. So I get it. But it feels like just from your stories that there is more of a sense of we're in this together.
There's definitely a community. I mean, I often say, you know, and again, for me, I've got to love the wine first and foremost in order to fight, because it's not easy to enter with a new product, enter with a new project, tell the story time and time again, wine under your arm and going in and going to battle with people who may not feel the same way you do about it. But I always feel that, you know, an importer or distributor, we're really part of the same team. We're all trying to do the same thing and express the terroir from another place. And lift people up and help farmers and help winemakers because it's a really tough living. And so I don't see as much of the jealousy. Of course, there's egos and there's arrogance.
Yeah.
Not in my case, because as much as I'm making my own cuvées and my name is going to show up on a wine label, it's really not about me. It's about our sales team. It's about my family who helped support me through the lean years when we first started. If it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be here, and I think every winemaker feels that. So there is this community that's really exciting. You see it, I think, more outside of Spain right now when we travel to France or to Italy, but of course there's always going to be, as we say in Spanish, envidias.
This final one is a big boy. Where is this final wine first? What's the name of it?
So
the producer?
So this is Pardas, cellar Pardas, which is half an hour south of Barcelona. This is the first year that he bottled from the single vineyard project that started in 1996. This is the 2005 Espriu single vineyard, half and half Cab Franc and Cab Sauve. Cab Franc goes back to when René Barbier, one of the first four pillars of Priorat, came to the region and then started to expand and brought Cab Franc. Ramon and Jordi, his partner, were inspired by their experiences with Cab Franc in Chinon. Ramon was also inspired by the Cab Franc here in Jordan, Ontario, with Francois Morissette,
yes.
Who is also a great friend. And they certainly we've had a lot of fun together over the years, mm-hmm. and a winemaker here that we really respect. But this is 2005. It's a three split between steel, barrel, and concrete. This is a big boy, mm-hmm. but boy, is there still life on this wine. I think there's tremendous acidity to this. A lot of people, when they drink this, I won't say the name of the restaurant, but with an owner of a very important restaurant, Italian restaurant on King West, and he felt that it was more like the Merlots, the Super Tuscans, just much. I mean, this is a big wine that sort of fits that trophy wine,
yep.
profile, but doesn't have the trophy wine price. So I would say to anyone who's looking for that kind of really full bodied, but still everything well balanced, it's like a great dish. Everything's got to be there: the acidity, the tannins, the fruit. And when we first opened, I was a little worried, but I think it's drinking beautifully.
What I like on the end, I was wondering how old it was. And by the way, it still has like the old expression, if there's fruit, there's a future. The fruit is all there. It hasn't gone away. But at the end, you know, I get a little bit of tawny, like 20-year-old tawny port. I get a little bit of those notes right on the finish. Like you're right, on the front, the fruit is all there. And there is that, I can see why someone goes Merlot, because there is this nice, opulent, full-bodied, rounded thing. It doesn't have that sharp Cabernet Sauvignon. But yeah, I get a little bit of this like port on the finish. Yeah, if for the Napa Cab drinker, the big wine drinker who wants to start dipping their toe into Spain, you're cheating a little bit because you got cabs. But at the same point, this is a great wine.
And you know, this is a very special wine. We had the 2007 vintage here for quite a few years until, interestingly enough, for his older vintages, the Cellar de Can Roca, which is typically one of the top three restaurants in the world, just outside of Girona, three-star Michelin restaurant. That restaurant and Cosecha Imports are the biggest buyers of all of his older vintages.
Really?
And he's a rescuer of indigenous varietals that haven't been in favor. I mean, he makes old vine Chirellos, which is a white varietal that goes into Cava, but has really been one of the pioneers in making it a still wine. Sumoy, which is like a cross between Nebbiolo and Pinot Noir. High acidity, a very difficult grape to farm. He's making gorgeous wines from them. And then here with this sort of outlier, Cab Franc, Cab Sauv. So it's really exciting to have this wine in market, and for the trust that he allows us to bring these wines into market, because he doesn't give it to everyone. And we have our own cuvée that we made with him. We're thinking about calling it Polar Boar. More to come on that cuvée, but very exciting that we can make these cuvées with these producers. But I'm glad you like it. And
goes great with cheese. I had it just had a little bit of Parmesan with it. So you talk about the acidity and stuff. Just this definitely goes with it. The perfume and the floral is all over the place on this as well. Like very, very present. Yeah, this is, I mean, they're all good. And you don't want to go, the last one I like the most. Because I don't know. I'd have to go back and think about it. I thought the nose on the white was one of the more remarkable things of the four. You know, I thought the finish on the last one, I love, because I love tawny port. I love the aging of this one, the freshness of the second, and then, you know, just the Rolodex of flavors going on the third wine, on the 100% Grenache.
Well, I think that's what's really exciting about portfolio, is it's about surprising and delighting people and not giving them something that falls into like the self-fulfilling prophecy of what they think about when they think of Spain. You know, we started today talking about Rioja, Ribera del Duero. There's a whole world of wine outside of these regions in Spain, and that's what's really exciting. As you know, climate change takes hold, as winemaking techniques, you know, in order to make the best wine, you have to travel abroad, you have to drink the best wine in the world. You know, if you asked our portfolio time and time again, what are they drinking, they would probably say, I'm drinking Riaz, I'm drinking Saldera. You know, I mean, these are mythical wines with mythical price points in many ways attached to them, but these are outliers, and so there's that same camaraderie of sort of misfits of wine that push the boundaries. Because I think, like in every industry, if you just follow the status quo and keep doing the same thing, Einstein said, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting different results. And it's the same thing with a lot of these winemakers. They're doing different things and the results are very different.
Absolutely. I think that's a great place to end it. I'll say a couple things first. I am a big, obviously, you know, I'm a big fan of your portfolio. Jason and his company did a great event, one of the last big events at the National Club before coronavirus. And I bought, I don't know, I think I still got to find it where my orders, I think things got lost, but I bought, I think, like 18 bottles of just some of your different stuff. And really what I wanted to do here, we did, which is give a little bit of a Spanish 101. Get people out there, try different Spanish wines from the norms. And yeah, we can crap on the LCBO, and rightfully so from time to time, but the LCBO will, you can find a lot of great Spanish wines from different regions, less known regions there. So I would encourage everyone to go try different Spanish wines, but forget about the LCBO, because why go in one? I haven't been one in February, and I tell everyone all the time, go buy from wineries or go to consignment companies like Jason's here. Jason, give everyone another promo, another plug. Where can people find your wine?
So we deliver contactless experience, artisanal wines delivered right to your door. CosechaImports.com, C-O-S-E-C-H-A Imports.com. And we will surprise and delight you, guaranteed.
Thank you very much, Jason, for doing this. I really appreciate some really fantastic, cool wines. And the great thing is I always learn. Every time I drink with you, I always learn. I always expand my own palate, my own palate knowledge. So I really appreciate it.
And when your listeners, when things, the skies do open up and you're able to come to Spain, please contact us. We, our winemakers, love to receive visits when things all settle. Stay safe, stay healthy, but keep drinking great wine and push the boundaries of your palate.
Perfect way to end this. Thanks everyone for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, Audioboom, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.